We are right in the middle of a very dicey time in King David's life. David has had the throne taken from him by none other than his son Absalom. Absalom led a rebellion against David. That rebellion was short-lived. David fled into the wilderness. Absalom with armies pursued. And in the course of things, Israel was suffered a great defeat. David given a wonderful victory. And our man Absalom dies in a very brutal way. This man was known as being very handsome, and he had these big flowing locks of hair. And we're told that as he's pursuing David, his hair got caught up in a tree. The mule kept going, and Absalom was left hanging, defenseless. Joab, the commander of David's army, gets word. He comes, he casts some spears, he kills Absalom. Word gets back to David that the rebellion has been thwarted, that Absalom has died, that the kingdom is his again. He weeps. He comes to the end of his mourning. He realizes it's time now to come back to Jerusalem. Now, David does something wise, and we touched on this at the end of last week's Bible study. David just doesn't assume that all of Israel would just rally right back around him. Absalom had been able to lead a rebellion because there was quite a few people within the kingdom of Israel that rallied around Absalom, that rejected David. And so David, in this kind of this limbo phase as he's coming back, he senses a need to be invited. Not to presume, but to wait, to be invited to return. And sure enough, the invitation is extended. There's some complications to it, but David now is making his way back across the Jordan. From the Jordan, he'll work his way through the Judean wilderness, heading up to Jerusalem, the capital of the empire. Now, where we left things off, David is making his way. But there's a few characters, some sub-stories that we've already looked at that we gain a bit of fruition or conclusion to. The first character that David encounters on his way back to Jerusalem is a man by the name of Shimei. Now, Shimei was a descendant of King Saul. And when David was fleeing Jerusalem as Absalom's armies were marching in, this man, Shimei, saw opportunity, well, to get at David. So as David is making his way across the Mount of Olives, this man, Shimei, is cursing him, is mocking him, is throwing stones at him. He's making quite a show of it. Now, for Shimei, the problem was is Absalom's rebellion failed, and guess who was coming back to the throne? Well, King David was. So this places Shimei in kind of a dicey situation. So it's no surprise we see the second half of verse 18. Now, Shimei, the son of Gera, comes to David. He falls down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan, and he said to the king, "Do not let my lord," and you're going to note how many times he said, my lord, I'm your servant, my lord. He's trying to hammer home an idea, sorry. "Do not let my lord impute iniquity to me. Or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord, the king, left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart." Hey, you remember, David? Just like a couple weeks ago when I was cursing you and throwing rocks. My bad. Simple mistake. Can we forget that and just kind of move along? He adds, verse 20, For your servant, I know I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." Now, this is important for Shimei, and it's likely what saves his life, is not only does he come and he offers an apology. Now, he's offering an apology, and it's a bit forced because he has no other options. And yet, he does carry this apology to an important place. Note, three significant words that a king always needs to hear. And in fact, your king. Do you know your King Jesus? He understands that you might go through seasons where you curse him. I know we're all on the up and up here, but have you ever been angry at Jesus? Have you ever been upset? Have you ever been disappointed by Jesus that he either allowed something to happen or he didn't intervene when you wanted him to? Have you in your own private life, your own devotional experience, poured yourself out to the Lord like David illustrates, real, raw, honest, but sometimes maybe You would forget and you're talking to King Jesus, who with a quick word can annihilate you? Have you ever maybe crossed the line in your honesty, pouring your heart out, and said some things maybe later on you regretted? I know I have, just to be honest. There have been times of heartache, of pain, of frustration, where you cry out to Jesus, why didn't you do fill in the blank? Why did you allow? Why weren't you there? Don't you love me? I'm called to your purposes. You say you will work all things for the good. I just don't see it. Have you ever said things to Jesus that in retrospect you might not have needed to say? You know, again, David being a bit of a picture of a greater David, Jesus. Shimei said some things he was now regretting. He took some action against his king he was none too proud about. But notice what he acknowledges. Not just his error, not just his mistake. He comes and he's like, David, I'd love for us to forget about all that. But you need to know, I have sinned. You know, those three words in the ears of your king go a long way. He knows you. He loves you. He cares for you. I have sinned. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. Now, quick recap. In the first interactions with Shimei, as he's cursing and yelling and kicking up dust and throwing stones, as he's making a scene, Abishai, who's one of David's like main men, he's a nephew. He tells David, he says, listen, I don't care if we're on the run or not. Can I go lop off his head? I'll shut him up permanently. And David at the time was like, Abishai, snap it. No. Now, Shimei comes back and Abishai's like, now's my turn. So Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, David's sister, he answered, he says, shall not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Let me at him, David. But David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? Abishai, his brother Joab, were constant thorns, that you should be adversaries to me today of all days. Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For I do not know that today I am the king over Israel. Therefore, the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. David has things in a proper perspective. A rebellion's been put down. The kingdom has been in chaos. There's factions, there's a lot of confusion. David is coming back to the throne, but he's like, this is a time for us not to be lopping off heads. It's a time for reconciliation. It's a time for peace. It's a time for us coming together and moving forward and even letting bygones be bygones. David had every right to tell Abishai, go after him. And yet David is willing to forgive and to move forward. Again, just in way of application, have you ever had somebody curse you? Speak evil of you? Have you ever had somebody throw stones at you? And then later on, they come back around and they realize, man, that was stupid. And they apologize and they want to move forward and they acknowledge their error. What do you do? I know what you want to do. You want to lop off the head. Or maybe curse back. Throw stones at a minimum. And yet we see a wonderful example from David, right? That there's a time for us to forgive, to see there be peace. Well, continuing as David is moving his way, more characters. Now, Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan. Years before this, David's heart stirred because of God's grace and his kindness. He wants to acknowledge any errors of Jonathan. Saul's son Jonathan was David's best friend, a mentor, a man that was much older, but really saw God's anointing in David's life. David sends word, I need to find, is there anyone alive from the home, from the family of Jonathan? And they found Mephibosheth, who was a cripple. And David sends for Mephibosheth, brings Mephibosheth into his family. Mephibosheth ate at his table. He honored a covenant, an agreement with Jonathan. He was so kind, David, to Mephibosheth. In fact, David restored to Mephibosheth all of Saul's property, all of his holdings. And then there was a man named Ziba, a servant of Mephibosheth, that David then gave charge to take care of the land for him, for he was a cripple. Now, as David is leaving Jerusalem, not only does he deal with Shimei, but this guy Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, ends up coming to David with a whole care package of food and stuff for the excursion into the wilderness. And David's like, Ziba, where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba tells David, well, Mephibosheth is seeing this as an opportunity for his family, the house of Saul, to regain influence within the country. Basically, you showed kindness to Mephibosheth, but now Mephibosheth has seen this as an opportunity to really get back at you. Now that stung David. That hurt. He had no reason to doubt Ziba. However, now, David is coming back. Mephibosheth comes out, the son of Saul, specifically the grandson of Saul, the son of Jonathan. He comes and he meets the king. Now, we're given a description here, and this is important. Now, Mephibosheth had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. Mephibosheth likely knows that Ziba has turned on him and has probably whispered lies into David's ear. Mephibosheth realizes that if David has believed Ziba, he's in trouble. And so he's physically presenting evidence that Ziba had lied about him, that he took no delight in this, no joy in this. He hadn't cared for his feet. And if you're a cripple, that can give rise to all kinds of disease. He hasn't washed himself. He hasn't trimmed his mustache. I mean, this guy looks like a cripple Spencer Strider. And he comes out. Thank you, Creighton. Appreciate the laugh. He comes out. He encounters David. So it was that when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? And that was just such an honest answer. There's no anger. You can feel some of the disappointment, the question itself. And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it, go to the king, because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who eat at your table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king? Mephibosheth, he makes his argument, he explains the situation, but notice what he comes back to. He says, David, you do what you want. I mean, the very fact I'm alive is your grace. Like the whole house of Saul should have been killed with the edge of the sword, and yet you looked on me and my distress and my plight. Based on a covenant that you made with another, you showed me such kindness. You just spared my life. I'm eternally indebted to you. Again, he's not making any argument on merit or the fact that he deserves this or he deserves that. He just says, you've just been good to me, and I know you'll be good. So the king said to him, why do you speak any more of these matters? I have said you and Ziba divide the land. Then Mephibosheth said to the king, rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. So when Ziba had come initially, as David is fleeing Jerusalem, and David is disappointed by what he has assumed the actions of Mephibosheth, he then tells Ziba, you can have all the land, enough of Mephibosheth, I'm going to write him off, it's all yours. You and your sons, you can take it all. Now that Mephibosheth has come, David concludes, you know, okay, I gave it all to you, then I gave it all to Ziba, you guys just split it. Let's just be done with this and move forward. But I love how Mephibosheth replies. He says, you know what? You can just give it all to Ziba. Like, I don't care. And again, there's kind of a theological debate. Like, was Ziba lying? Was Mephibosheth lying? Have you ever been in a spot where, like, you're really not sure who's telling the truth? Like, you're doing your best to try to weed things out. And so David's like, well, just divide it. And then likely by the reaction of Mephibosheth, like, you know, no. We're not told in the text, but I think he takes it back from Ziba and he gives it back to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth ends up being restored back to his position. Regardless, it is interesting and worth noting that who's also present watching all these things? Like a 12, 13, 14-year-old Solomon. So the child of David, the second child of David and Bathsheba, his name is Solomon. David's son of peace. That's what the word means. And Solomon is a teenager, and he's there, and he's watching how his father handles situations. We know he'll become the king. He'll become the heir. Interesting that within this situation, he sees, okay, I don't know who's telling the truth. I don't know who's lying. But the person that then makes the decision, you know what, just keep it all together. I'm out. It's all right. It's probably the one telling the truth. Because there'll come a situation later on as Solomon is king that you have two women that come to Solomon. And they're saying, one of the ladies saying, this is my baby. And the other one's like, no, that's my baby. And Solomon has to figure out whose baby it is. And so he says, okay, easiest solution here, cut it in half. You each get part. Knowing that the real mother is going to spare the child, right? And that's his way of figuring out. Where did he get that idea? Could it have been like this story, seeing how David handled similar situations? Continuing, verse 31, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, came from Roglim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Barzillai is a character, again, we saw earlier as David is making his way into the wilderness. This man, Barzillai, was a very wealthy individual, an older gentleman, but he was loyal to David. And so in the midst of this divided kingdom, this civil war, he sides with David. And he, because of his wealth, his power, his connections, goes to a great extent to take care of David while he's in the wilderness. He provides David and his men supplies and food and shelter. So Barzillai is with David as they're making their way back across the Jordan. Barzillai, an author's note, was a very aged man, 80 years old, which was quite old in those days. And he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed in Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. So a bit of the recap of their connection. So the king said to Barzillai, come with me, and I will provide for you while you're with me in Jerusalem. So David is interested in repaying kindness to Barzillai. You've taken care of me. Why don't you come back to Jerusalem, and I'll take care of you. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm 80 years old. Can I discern between good and bad? Like, dude, I'm losing it, man. I forget my own. I'm not going to be much help. I can never find the remote. Can your servant taste what I eat, what I drink? Hey, it sounds great going to Jerusalem, best food, best drink. I'm 80. I can't see. I can't taste. I mean, it might be the best steak you got, but my dentures will not hold up to whatever you're putting in front of me. Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men or women? These hearing aids, they don't work. Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with you. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city, near the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant, Chinham. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. So Barzillai is honored by David's demonstration of kindness, but he has his reasons. He's like, listen, I mean, this is the Jerusalem gang, that's a young man scene, and I am not a young man. In fact, you know what I want? I want a good hillside and a rocking chair. I want to be close to where I'm going to be buried. Like, just let me die. Let me die in peace. Instead of Jerusalem, just let me go. I got a golf cart, the villages, and a golf course. Just let me enjoy my final years. I don't need any of that. Appreciate it, David. That being said, because I know you want to demonstrate kindness to me, here is this man Chimham. Chimham, it would appear from 1 Kings 2:7, is the son of Barzillai. We're not told here, but we get another context. Here's my son. He'll enjoy all of this stuff. You take him with you. All the kindness you want to show me, show my son. Set him up, utilize him, take him. That will be great. And so the king answered, Chimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now, whatever you request of me, I will do for you. And then all the people went over the Jordan. The king crossed over. The king kissed Barzillai, blessed him. He returned to his own place. As a small side detail about this man, Chimham, and how different stories connect in unique ways. We can't say this with 100% certainty because we have to rely on just a little bit of Hebrew tradition. And yet, according to Jeremiah 41, verse 17, part of the gig here with Chimham coming with David to Jerusalem. Remember, David was from what city? He was from the city of Bethlehem. Bethlehem was about 2 miles outside of Jerusalem, kind of a suburb of Jerusalem. But David, his family, they owned quite a bit of land around Jerusalem in the fields of Bethlehem. Now, Chimham, according to Jeremiah 41, 17, was given a parcel of David's land in Bethlehem as kind of an inheritance. And it seems as though that in Bethlehem, which was a very small city, it was mainly a farming community. What was David? David was a shepherd. He tended sheep. Not a very populated area. And yet, it was kind of a resting place for travelers that were making their way from Jerusalem to Egypt. We're told, and the phrase used in Jeremiah, is there's reference to the habitation of Chimham in Bethlehem. And the word habitation, again within the Hebrew, means that it was a resting place for weary travelers. We have another word that we use for that. In fact, you'll find it in Luke chapter 2, verse 7. We call it an inn. Now, later into the story, Mary and Joseph will make their way to Bethlehem. And what will they not find room? They will not find room in an inn. It could very well be that this was the habitation of Chimham given to him by David so many years before. Just a side connection you might find interesting. Verse 40. Now the king went on to Gilgal. Chimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king. Also half the people of Israel. Just then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have your brother and the men of Judah stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all of David's men with him across the Jordan? So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a very close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? So David came from the tribe of Judah. That was his tribe. And in case you're kind of new to the Bible, you had Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. Jacob's name is changed towards the end of the book of Genesis to Israel. That's where we get the children of Israel are the descendants of Israel, Jacob. And of those descendants of Jacob, you have 12 tribes. Those are the 12 sons of Jacob. So that's where we get the 12 tribes. The tribe of Judah would be what? The descendants that come from Jacob's son, Judah. That would be the kingly tribe. You have the tribe of Dan in the far north. Those are the descendants, want to take a guess, of Jacob's son, Dan. So this is how this all works. So you have the big southern tribe, Judah. That is David's tribe. That's also the territory in which Jerusalem, the capital, is located. David is making his way through the territory of Judah back to the capital of Israel that's in Judah. He himself comes from the tribe of Judah. And so the rest of the other tribes are like, wait a second. This seems like why are you guys just getting all the favor and the attention? We need some attention because there's been a civil war. And so they're like, man, it seems like the North's getting too much attention and the southern states are being ignored. Like, again, you're in a reconciliation type of reconstruction dynamic coming after Absalom. So there's some warring factions. Judah argues back, like, we've never, like, taken our position for special treatment or anything like that. Knock it off. Now, this will sow seeds of future problems. Ultimately, David's son, Solomon, will have a son, Rehoboam, so David's grandson, and he'll come, he'll levy taxes. We'll get to this probably in 4 years from now. But the tribes will split. You'll have the southern kingdom, which is called Judah. Benjamin kind of gets adopted in, whose capital will be Jerusalem. And then you'll have Israel, which is the 10 northern tribes. So like even at this point, we're getting this detail that there's already like bad blood between these territories, between these tribes. Verse 43, so the men of Israel answered the men of Judah. They said, we have 10 shares in the kingdom. There are 10 of us, one of you. We also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. So they're all fighting over David. If you know anything about people, this is going to like quickly change. Like they all go from fighting over David, Hosanna, Hosanna to King. And then like a few days later, what are they saying? Crucify him, crucify him. Look at verse 1 of chapter 20. And there happened to be there a rebel whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, the Benjaminite. And he blew a trumpet and he said, we have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. And then we read, so every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, and the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal to the king. So right here immediately, we have the 10 tribes. Well, David's our king. And Judah's like, well, he's our king. And then Sheba's like, hey, why don't we just have no king? And they're all like, great idea. Like how fickle and quick fleeting the attention, the accolades, the love of people. And so now you have a second rebellion here. You had the first rebellion of Absalom. You have now a second, the lesser known, the rebellion of Sheba. His argument, and notice, look back, he says, we have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. He's from Judah. He's all about Judah. He doesn't care about us at all. And then he says, the son of Jesse. Now, it's true that that was a statement of fact, but who was Jesse in addition to being David's dad? He's a nobody. He was a poor, rural shepherd, which is why it was so shocking when Samuel came to the house of Jesse to anoint a king. It's the last place you would have looked. So Sheba's like, hey, David didn't care about us. You know, the son of that insignificant nobody, Jesse. Every man to his tents. Or literally, he's saying, go do your own thing. We don't need a king. Now, David came to his house, verse 3, at Jerusalem. And the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house. He put them in seclusion and supported them. But did not go into them, so they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. Verse 3 has nothing to do at all with the story we're looking at. But again, as we've seen in other places, it's an author's note, just kind of recapping the plight of a particular group of women. David had wives and he had concubines. David left the concubines when he fled Jerusalem back in the city. Absalom defiled these women in a very brutal, public way. David gets back to Jerusalem. He has to like clean up on Isle Absalom. He's very kind to these women in the sense that he doesn't just get rid of them, but he does put them away. They live in a widowhood. He takes care of them. He provides for them. But they had been defiled. Awkward. Verse 4, now the king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and present here yourself. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. Now, in 2 Samuel 19, verse 13, we looked at it last week. David is trying to create some peace. He's trying to extend some olive branches. Joab had been David's commander, but Absalom had picked another one of David's relatives, this man, Amasa, to be his general. Now, Amasa has already a terrible track record. He aligned himself with the traitor, and he led a rebellion that failed. David had every right to have the guy whacked, but he doesn't. Instead, because of some of Joab's actions, he demotes Joab, and he promotes Amasa to being the commander over his armies. And this was a token of reconciliation, bringing everyone back. We can bury the hatchet. We can move forward. Amasa is an interesting character. So he comes from the tribe of Judah. There's this rebellion. David's not going to give any time for it. He tells Amasa, go to Judah, assemble some troops, bring them. And yet, David gave him 3 days. The third day comes and goes. Who's not back with men from Judah? Amasa. So David, verse 6, says to Abishai, now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. He's more dangerous than Absalom. Take your Lord's men, pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us. Again, if he can get to a fortified city, then there's a siege. It becomes more complicated. David is not allowing this to continue. He's going to put an end to it abruptly. He gave instructions to Amasa. Amasa tarried, so he turns to Abishai. He says, you go. We're not going to wait for Amasa. You go, pursue. We can't wait. Now, who's behind the surface in all of this? Joab. So Joab's men. So he's not the commander anymore, but he's got dudes. Joab's men with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, the mighty men, these were two non-Jewish groups that lived in the land that David had adopted as kind of his commandos, his secret service. They were loyal to David, not Israel. So they were his protective guard. Joab takes these assassins, these men. And they're going to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Verse 8, when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa now comes before them. So Amasa catches up. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at the hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Then Joab said to Amasa, are you in health, my brother? All right, get the scene. Amasa is the commander of David's armies because Joab has been demoted. Everything we know of Joab, you think Joab's going to be like cool with that? Hardly. Joab was a cold-blooded murderer. Joab is the guy that gets a handwritten note carried by Uriah from David, saying, you need this guy, I need this guy killed. Does Joab question it? Does he? No. In fact, he creates a bit of a better plan. He has Bathsheba's husband murdered. Joab was amidst the whole tale. He knows the dirty deed. He carried it forth. He was deeply loyal to David to the point he would do things that no other man was allowed to do, and David never dealt with it. He would defy commands, defy orders, but he always did what David couldn't. He always had his back, his best intentions in mind. We're going to see this. So Amasa, this man, has been promoted as a peace accord. And Joab's like, this is a bad move. It's a bad move because Amasa doesn't know anything about war. It's a bad move because he aligned with a traitor. He can't be trusted. David, I understand what you're doing, but this guy's bad news. And if you're not going to deal with it, I'm the man. So there they are. They're at the stone of Gibeon. Amasa finally catches up. Now Joab's dressed in battle array. He's got this belt, we're told, with a sheath. He's got a sword on it. Now the sheath and the sword fall out onto the ground. Is that an accident? No. Let's see what happens. So he says to Amasa, are you in health, my brother? How you doing? You doing good? Joab took Amasa by the beard. with his right hand. Again, the right hand, the hand of strength. Grabs him by the beard to kiss him. It's a common greeting. Non-threatening because you fought with your right. Very few people were left-handed. So, verse 10, Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand. So it's not as though that Joab pulls out the sword to greet Amasa. That would have been a dead giveaway. He's dropped the sword, and he picks it up as he goes to greet Amasa. He doesn't know that Joab has it in his left hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach. This is his family, by the way. And his entrails, his guts, poured out on the ground. One movement of the blade. He did not strike him again. Thus he died, or probably in the better tense, he's dying. So Joab kills Amasa. This is in your Bible. I mean, we're only here because this is where we're at. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, follow Joab. So it's like, hey, we're going to divide it up. You're going to follow this joker who's laying here dying, or you're following Joab. And everyone's kind of frozen in fear. Why? Verse 12, because Amasa is wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. His guts are out. He's dying a brutal death. And people are like, freak out. So the man who made this declaration saw that all the people stood still. So what does he do? He moved Amasa from the highway to the field. It's like roadkill. And he threw a garment over him. And when he saw that everyone who came upon him halted, and when he was removed from the highway, then all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all of the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Makkah and all the Berites. This town, Abel, it's in the very upper Galilee. It's in the northern part of Israel, almost once you get to Lebanon. So they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. And they came and besieged him and Abel of Beth Makkah. And they cast up a siege mound against the city. And it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. So the scene is David's worst fear is realized. Sheba has gotten himself to the far north, and he's gotten himself into a fortified city. Sieges could take years. So they've already gotten there. They've built a siege mound. They're attacking the city. Joab is a ravenous wolf. They're beating on the walls. They're gonna overthrow this town because they're going to get to Sheba. Now, with that context established, a wise woman cried out from the city. So this wise old woman comes up to the top of the wall. She cries out, "Hear, hear, please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak to him." So she wants to speak to Joab. And when he came to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He said, "I am." And she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he says, "I'm listening." What dialogue? So she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely seek guidance at Abel. And so they would end disputes. Abel was a town of peace," is what she's saying. "I am among the peaceable and the faithful in Israel. We've done nothing wrong. But yet you seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of Israel? So what are you doing? Why are you attacking us? What's the problem here?" So Joab answered and said, Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not so, but a man from the mountain of Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I'll depart from the city. So our battle's not with you. You've got a traitor, a rebel, in your fortified wall, so that's why we're here. You can deal with this, or I can deal with this. This woman and Joab are very similar in tact. So the woman said to Joab, "Watch, his head will be thrown over to you from the wall." So the woman and her wisdom went to the people. They cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and they threw it over the wall to Joab. So he blew a trumpet. They withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. And Joab, we're told, verse 23, was over all the armies of Israel. So the David doesn't deal. Joab has killed the commander of David's armies. Cold-blooded murder. Gutted him like a fish. Let him bled out in agony. Does David deal with Joab even here? Nope. Will David deal with Joab? Yep. That'll be a future study. But then Joab is now back over the armies of Israel. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Adoram was in charge of revenue. Jehoshaphat, the son of Eliad, was recorder. Sheva was scribe. Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. And Ira, the Jerite, was a chief minister under David. A readministering of the kingdom, a new administration, new roles, new people. I want to close with one final thought of that. Because there's a new office instituted by David. This man here, the last verse, Ira, the Jerite, was a chief minister under David. This is an incredibly unique phrase in the Hebrew language. So unique, we really don't see it in any other context. There are variations in how this can be translated. It could be translated as personal priest, chief minister, personal priest, personal chaplain, private pastor. It's interesting. There's a whole new role established. Now, David, all of this stuff with Absalom, like this entire like 3 weeks of studies, several chapters, this whole narrative has happened as the consequence of David's idiotic, sinful, immoral choices. He sowed to the wind and he has reaped the whirlwind. That doesn't mean that people didn't have individual choices, but David recognizes that this whole rebellion, this whole uprising of Absalom, this whole retreat into the wilderness, almost losing the kingdom, these are things that could have been avoided if David had gone to war and not gone up on a rooftop and had not called for the identity of the woman and had not laid with her and had not made the terrible choices that he had made. David is the sweet psalmist of Israel. He is the king after God's own heart. He is such a significant character in your Old Testament, in spite of his sin, which is many, that Jesus will identify himself as the son of David. And yet David, for all of these wonderful attributes, has some serious flaws. And David comes back from a season of consequence. He comes back to Jerusalem, and David realizes something important. I need accountability. Like, I can't do this on my own. In fact, I was the problem, meaning I can't be the solution, and dadgummit, I need some help. And so David creates a position in his cabinet and his administration. He calls this man Ira, the Jerite. And he says, there are priests for Israel, there are intercessors for the people, but I need someone in my life that can walk to my right, that can call me to account, that can challenge me day in and day out. Am I following the Lord? Like, please, in conclusion, understand, in no way, shape, or form, within any passage of your scriptures, is Christianity presented to be a go-it-alone proposition. It is not designed for it to be you and Jesus versus the world. In today's day and age, there are people that are like, hey, I've been burned by the church, I've been hurt by the church, and as a result, I don't need the church. I don't need the church. I got my Bible, and I got Jesus, and I can go it alone. First, on a side, I will challenge you. It is very difficult. It is very difficult for someone to say that they love Zach Adams and hate Jessica, my wife. We're going to have a problem. It's going to be very, very difficult for you and I to be BFFs if you hate my wife. We're a package deal. And yet it's very difficult for someone to say, I love Jesus, I'm going to follow Jesus, but I hate his wife. It's his bride. Is she flawed? Absolutely. But she's still his bride. So setting that aside, every bit of ministry, every different path, you'll never find someone in your New Testament going it alone. Jesus even went into the garden to pray, and he had the 12, and then he had 3. Jesus surrounded himself with friends, with community, with brothers, with sisters. You see, part of the thing that got David into trouble is that he had isolated himself. Again, when kings go into war, meaning everyone he's been doing battle with for his entire life is out there and he's just chilling by himself. And he comes to the conclusion in wisdom here at the end, as he's now coming back, we're going to do this. I need someone with me. I can't do this alone. Paul goes into the mission field and he takes with him Barnabas. And then when Barnabas goes out with Mark, he takes with him Silas. And then he's in various places and he'll pick up Luke to travel with him. And if not Luke, it'll be Titus, or he'll call for Timothy. Paul was always with someone, because the Christian experience is not a go-it-alone proposition. And if you try to do it alone, no one's got your back. And more important than your back, there's nobody to stand in front of you and to say, stop it, you're being stupid. David didn't have that. He comes back after experiencing terrible consequences. He's like, you know what? I got the treasurer, I got the administrators, I got all these other people, but you know what? They serve the kingdom. I need somebody that will stand with me, in front of me, and if I'm going to do something dumb, I will have someone to warn me. A chief minister. Do you have a chief minister? Do you have people in your life that are not yes men, are not people that will pat you on the back, but if they see you doing something dumb, are willing to risk the friendship for deeper brotherhood? Well, if I confront them, then maybe we won't be friends anymore. Well, if they ruin their life, you're not going to be friends anyway. Are you willing to risk the friendship because you're family? I hope you have that kind of person. And if you don't, be that type of person to someone else, and you'll come to find out that they'll be that to you as well. I can't help but also note that rebelling against the king is not a way to get ahead. So, Father, Lord, we'll just leave that there.